is 11:34 a.m. for Tuesday, January 27th, 2025. Members present are Representative Shirley Jackson, Stormy, Edgar, myself, Spangles. We do require that the business manager talk to each other, and we are very pleased to do that. As soon as you make phone calls, whatever is assigned to the attorney, and then by registering, do not know I have that you're in the Friday. All right, so today we're going to continue our work that we started on earlier. We're going to hear some invited testimony on the road impacts on legal policy and who bears up in nonprofit service providing in our schools. Next, we're going to look at some opportunities for efficiency, and I thought it was really important that we understand there's the tailored budget austerity for the last 7 years. So we're going to be hearing from kind of the people and organizations across the state. They have delivery responsibilities to deliver services paid for by state government. So first, we're going to hear from Terry Cousin with the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, Nathan Greenberg, Michelle Durant, Executive Director of Health Community Resources, and Pride of District 16 resident. Third, we'll hear a short presentation from Dr. Lisa Kennedy, the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and testimony from the school district superintendent, Dr. Bridget Rice. And then fourth, we will hear testimony from Ron Davidson, Executive Director of the Alaska Association of Alaska School Boards, on impacts to school districts. Are there any questions from members of the committee before we begin? No. All right. So that we're going to finish up to Bridget Rice. Go ahead and introduce yourself in the record and proceed to your testimony, and Megan Holland here will be addressing your slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a quick sound check. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Thank you.
Perfect. On the record, my name is Gerard Cousin. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Today, we talk about Medicaid spending and the impact on health care. It affects that. So before I do that, I do want to introduce the organization I represent. I represent CASHTA, and obviously, as you can see, the shared interests. Alaska's hospitals, nursing homes, and healthcare partners to build a united, sustainable system of care for all Alaskans. We've had the privilege to represent all of Alaska's hospitals, nursing homes, and key partners for over 60 years. And that's all of this. So today I'm going to talk about Medicaid spending, fiscal policy, and the impact on healthcare. We start by looking at the future, predicting the future. What are the next 10 years look like? What are the sources telling us? And that's about when I talk about why it's important. And to understand that, it's important to look at payer mixes and how it varies by provider type and what it all means. After we do that, we kind of ask the question, well, what if we get this wrong? What's the harm? We're going to demonstrate that from a global perspective by looking at access to care. And after that, we ask one more time, really, what happens if we get it wrong? And we're going to provide you a very practical example to show what it can do. Finally, we'll conclude at that point on what we should do looking forward, how we plan in the industry in 10-year periods, and how it relates to the presentation today. So, unless there's any questions, I will proceed with the next slide. Now, looking to the future, within the next 10 years, we know there's sources out there for Medicaid. We obviously have the 10-year fiscal plan, and that 10-year fiscal plan is essentially saying that it's going to flat fund Medicaid from year one to year two, and then it's projecting after that 1% annual growth through the 10-year cycle. So that's one target after that 1% target. Then we have the estimation report, which is the Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska forecast. It's known as kind of the Medicaid long-term forecast. It covers 20-year cycles, and it's updated every year. So if you look at last year's report, it was projecting 3.8% increased spend per recipient per year for Medicaid. And now, just this morning, the 2022 report just came out, and actually downgraded that projection to 2%. So the first year is on the left-hand side. We have a variety of targets. We have a 1% target, which is aggressive, a 3.8% target, which might be moderate, and then, of course, we just talked about 2%. But we think it's important also look at historic performance. And to do that, you can look on the right-hand side of this big box at unrestricted general fund appropriations and actual spending for Medicaid. seems so different. And the last big pivotal phase, looking back before the pandemic, is probably Medicaid expansion, which took effect in September of 2015. So I think it's important to start really after that, you know, what's the over 3-year period in data science of how Medicaid is performed. So if you do that, you probably take 2016 to 2019. It's post expansion, pre-pandemic. It's a good period to evaluate. From there, if you look at the year-to-year change in spend, in appropriation and actual spend, it can be very telling. So if you look at from 16 to 17, and how it changed from 17 to 18, the changes are 18 to 19, you got it. And the average goes out, you get a reasonable annual average growth rate. But if you do that for 2016 to 2019, the appropriation annual growth rate is 2.1%. The average actual spend is about 1.9%. So that's pretty interesting. You can say, or help you ballpark with some of the solutions I just talked about, and maybe we're in the ballpark. Let's just say we are for Paul's conversation here. If we are, the question has to be, what did it take to get there? Well, we would argue from a service standpoint, it took a lot of adverse actions. And those actions are 3 years in a row of no inflation adjustments to Medicaid rates, and even a 5% rate cut. So that's a pretty significant negative action towards the Medicaid program to produce the result above. So then even if you set that aside, all right, you look in the past, you talked about how things came to us, what about the most recent 3 years? We can do that. Here we are. You look at 2020 to 2023, the green box is there. Now, for that, you can't really look at actual spend because the stats aren't available. We just want to get forward a little bit. But you can look at appropriations. If you do that same methodology I just described, you come up with 0.7% average annual growth rate. Well, there you go. You know, we've hit our target. If there's not an annual goal of 1% or below the Mesa report. But I ask the question again, well, what did it take? I think we all know what this one took. Took a once-in-a-lifetime global pandemic, which caused Medicaid utilization and healthcare service utilization to drop off a cliff. And you can see that with the change in UGF below. You have a 13.4% dive or decrease in 20. And then, again, year over year, you look at 21, you almost have a 5% decrease. Not only does that from utilization drop due to the pandemic, but it also has to do with the enhanced FMAP that's passed by Congress. And what that is the federal government is providing an enhanced match for Medicaid poverty by plus 36.2%. So simply stating we have a lot more federal dollars flowing in and lower utilization. Is that sustainable for a 10-year period looking forward? The answer is obviously not. We would not want to recreate that. So it's pretty tough. Let's look at the next slide.
Before we proceed with our presentation, I want to recognize that Representative Eastman joined us on the line for the information. Great.
Thank you. And there you go. The next slide is really, why is this important? You know, we just talked about projections, historic lessons, we look at past performance, we look at, reports, things like that. Well, everybody has a why. Why do we do this? How does this really affect you? And how does this affect all providers? And a good way of looking at it is the payer mix. And the payer mix is a way of showing, in this particular way I'll talk about it, is showing volumes or services provided by payer type. So that chart on the right is a hypothetical payer mix that I would say is a reasonable hypothetical for a hospital in Alaska. And mind you, if you are in a different part of Alaska, this is going to look different. But generally speaking, for this conversation, I think it's reasonable to look at this as, right, this is probably the ballpark for a payer mix for at least a few hospitals in Alaska. And this is relevant for three reasons. First of all, it shows the Medicaid wins. In this hypothetical payer mix, Medicaid accounts for almost 30% of the volume. Now, to us, that's a significant wedge. The point about that is acceptable 5 years ago, that Medicaid bridge would go up to about 90%. That means 90% of the services in a nursing home really come from Medicaid. And what that means is any change in fiscal policy from a Medicaid standpoint in the negative is going to significantly impact operations in a nursing home. And then if you were to take this and you can apply to certain behavioral health providers, assisted living homes, certain behavioral providers, that Medicaid bridge can get to about 100%. And whether or not it's something, any penny that gets moved in Medicaid is going to directly impact operations. So Medicaid's a big deal for all of healthcare, no matter which way you look at it. And now the third reason that the pyramid is that there's wrong in here is going back to the hospital example and the graph you have in front of you in the chart, over 50% of that pyramid is made up of government programs, namely Medicare and Medicaid. And government programs often pay less than cost, which means we're starting operations in a deficit. And when you're starting operations in a deficit, then you're going to make that deficit up by essentially increasing costs on everybody else, and therefore driving the cost of care. So Medicaid plays a fundamental part in the way healthcare finances, healthcare fiscal policy, all the functions, whether it's a hospital, or nursing home, or any provider. So let's go to the next slide. So now we know that I promised earlier we're going to ask the question, what if you get this wrong? And we'll talk about this kind of academic, but we know we're going to give you the specifics on the next slide. But what if you get this wrong? What if you manipulate that Medicaid bridge and decrease it too much? What's the practical effect? For that, we will look at the healthcare continuum. And this is a basic paradigm we came up with to demonstrate healthcare is interconnected, no matter what provider type you are. And in Alaska, the concept is it's a continuum. You're going to flow through the healthcare system. You're going to enter it in different places, and you're going to exit it in different places. So the point of this pyramid is the lower level or lower intensity that your services are, the cheaper they're going to be. Likewise, the more sophisticated and intense services require, the more expensive it's going to be. The most expensive place for healthcare is in a hospital outpatient environment. Also, the opposite, the least expensive, is in the community, like the primary care level. So the problem is, if Medicaid is not proportionately aligned correctly for provider plans, it can create a deficit in your capacity. If you create a deficit in your capacity, you simply drive all healthcare to the most expensive setting, and it gets stuck there. And when it gets stuck there, it generates large sums of uncompensated care that then gets absorbed by everybody else. And so the examples that we're about to get on the next slide are eventually you find your home in that primary emergency department when you need to be driving primary care, but you don't have access to primary care. Once you're in a hospital, you may be ready to leave that hospital, you might need to go to a nursing home. If you finish nursing home beds, fewest nursing home facilities in the country. Both of them are buildings are a real problem. But where do you go? You don't leave the hospital because you can't be safely discharged. So you sit in the hospital and you turn to the uncompensated care because you don't ever meet criteria for being in the hospital. Payers aren't going to pay you. Same thing for assisted living homes, same thing for behavioral health. We have patients who get stuck who can't get out. Let's advance forward. And ask the question at the end and spend some time there. Okay, really what happens if you get wrong? Let's have a practical example. This example I dug is going to scale. An example uses the state of Alaska General Relief Assisted Living Home Program. Now, this is, we're talking today about Medicaid. It's not a Medicaid program, but it's directly related to Medicaid. So, there's relevant for conversations here. The General Relief Assisted Living Home Program provides assistance to Alaskans who, number one, they lack resources to meet an urgent need. And number two, they're not eligible for any other programs, such as Medicaid. So in this instance, they need to go to an assisted living home, but they don't have the resources and they're not yet eligible for Medicaid. What do you do? General Relief Program comes in. This program has a waitlist system. That system prioritizes those discharges. driving me. But here's a quote we talked to one facility. We talked the other day about this topic, and it comes up a lot. And they said, we currently have 7 patients in knee replacement because the system within facilities won't accept the $70 a day GI beds. But let's be clear, it's not the system that handles them. It's a very, even if it's obvious, that makes probably not adequate. It hasn't been touched for so long. So the hospital goes on to say, if our numbers are this high, I can't imagine how many patients other hospitals have. And it's kind of compelling, but so what, 7 patients? Is that really a big deal? Just one of those patients, one of the 7, has been in the hospital for 117 days. And who left the hospital after 7? One of the primary reasons they can't be discharged is because they're waiting to qualify for Medicaid. Because no assisted living facility will take them because of the GR rate, the general rate frame. And as a follow-up, the legislation doesn't just stop here. This goes back to the concept of fiscal policy and impact. It's widespread. This same facility, talked about yesterday, has 18 patients only in placement. Those 18 patients combined for 656 patient days. So far, with clock ticking, passes, they've been in the hospital for 415 days that they didn't need to be there. Why? Well, paramedic is the general rate example, which I gave you a very practical example that affects everybody. Another example, behavioral health. There's not adequate presence of community behavioral health providers because the reimbursement for Medicaid, which for them is going to be 90 to 100% of their benefits, is not adequate. Set amounts they require type. No one wants to do it. They can't get paid enough to stay in business. So they're not there. So what happens? People go to a hospital and my system can stop them. We scale processes. And this isn't the department's fault. This is a widespread problem. They take anywhere from 45 days to 4 months to qualify for Medicaid. All of what you said in the most expensive environment of care. So it's a vastly valid site. So, to end on, how do you look at fiscal policy? How do you look at Medicaid and all these targets that we talk about are they reasonable to follow? Well, the Medicaid programs are somewhat complex. I get it. I used to personally work in it and improve in my career. But it's really complex, it's also extremely simple. The formula is very obvious. If you want to change Medicaid, and you want to change Medicaid, it's simple. It's a unit of the rate, and that's the unit of your spend. So it's a unit of service, and the rate of payment is going to equal your Medicaid expenditure. Now, sure, if you want to work in a hospital, so you're looking at the unit, are you going to change the Medicaid spend budget to the quantity of units? Are you going to change the service type? The rate, that's the price that Medicaid's going to pay for healthcare, and ultimately, this all flows into the budget. So the takeaway here is that progressive targets over 10-year periods, they can be met, but they take some pretty critical steps. The first one is planning. What are you going to do with utilization and a progressive target? Are you talking about quantity, or are you talking about service type, or both? Coming from the hospital and nursing home world, we think the biggest opportunity to do this is a demonstration project. We have multiple members that would test innovative payment models, but they improve our budget neutral that will actually return that investment over a period of time. We have one Medicaid Peninsula, they want to green light a real demonstration project around care coordination in a medical home model. So if they're doing it working, that's the type of way to change that. Service category payment. We've been working with the Department of Health and Social Services extremely well for the last year and a half to change the way hospitals are paid. To a PRT payment system to go from value to value, but we're still working on it. And that's part of the reason we support efforts to the executive order to reorganize the department. More attention on healthcare delivery and changing healthcare, that's how you achieve aggressive targets. And now you've got to project. It's not about doing the math of what you want to see and work backwards. It's about starting with what your plan is, how you're going to change it, and then doing the math 10 years out, so you can hit a target. That's how we do it by an industry. That's how we do it on capital projects. That's appreciate the opportunity to be here and happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much for that. First, I'd like to ask you, Chair, Mr. Benson, the rest of those questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. $170 a day up from 70 solve most of your problems in this area? And two, is this general fund, is this a line item in the last budget?
If I would bring more providers programmers because they have more financial funding than they do. So, again, that is how you impact it. So, account coordination is another service. Actually, having a good care coordinator to match all this is a time thing. It takes so long to qualify, to go through the waiver process, go through all the eligibility checks, work with the families. If the paperwork doesn't match up, people are stuck for months. That requires payment of a care coordinator that starts on the Medicaid, so it's paying care coordination services at an appropriate rate. If you get that wrong, you're in big trouble. And I know there's issues there, potentially right now, with dual eligibles and a payment issue that can affect care coordination services. But those are two very important examples that would come by at me.
Yes, thank you. My name is Michelle Brown. I'm the Executive Director for Home Community Resources. I'm also the Board President for the Key Coalition in Alaska. Home Community Resources has been a provider of community supports in Alaska for 53 years. Based in Anchorage, we offer services in Kodiak, the Kenai Peninsula, including Seward, the Moxie Valley, and Deep Yarrow. Up until this past year, we provided support in Dillingham, but we were not able to maintain those supports due to the fiscal dynamic we're talking about today. The Key Coalition of Alaska is mostly anonymous, comprised of stakeholders representing people experiencing disabilities, their families and advocates, and a range of providers providing services from implementing programs to learning adolescent programs and adult services. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share the impact of fiscal policy on the supports sector, serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I've been working in this sector in Alaska for almost 40 years, and the current dynamic is the most challenging I've ever faced. I can validate fiscal constraints have been an impact to quality supports for most of my career, but our state fiscal crisis, combined with 2 years of a pandemic-related challenges, is pushing the community provider system toward a brink of collapse. HVN has received a copy of this study that was contracted by the Association of Providers, AADD, with Effective Health Design Center, how many of you also know. A very great study. When you look at it, it's a comprehensive study. It's it will answer most all of your questions, all the new things that I'm going to be talking about. And I'm going to give you an overview of some of the challenges that were brought out of the study and see what path with a desired correction. To give a brief history, for those who may not be aware, prior to statehood, individuals with disabilities were sent out to state for services. In the early 60s, these individuals were brought back to Alaska and relocated to Harbor View Developmental Center in the Maldives. In the late 1960s, with the help of state and federal grants, community services began to emerge in Alaska. Services were funded primarily by state grants until 1993. When Alaska's Medicaid program obtained federal approval to offer home and community-based services for those people with disabilities who met an institutional level of care. Those who did not meet this institutional level of care were continued to be supported through state grants. Through collective advocacy, Harborview, our state institution, closed in 1997, and Alaska became one of the few states in the nation without a designated institution for people with disabilities. A source of pride for most of us at the time. Although there was a hesitancy to move to a system dominated by Medicaid funding, providers were told at the time that the cost savings would be utilized to serve more people in the community. Initial reimbursement for services provided through the waiver were individualized to the specific service recipient. Administrative and general costs could not exceed 18%. And were approved by the Medicaid State Agency. At the time, it was DMHDD. The transition to national billing codes in 2004 were accompanied by regulatory changes, which encouraged providers to seek reimbursement from DHSS via a cost-based negotiated rate. Rates were aggregated across all services and were no longer individualized to the person. So we can serve somebody with a high acuity and you serve somebody more easily about being the same or both, and it was up to providers to hopefully, in the aggregate, be able to stay in business. Regulations in 2006 allowed for increase in the cost per unit of service if the enhanced service was needed to protect the health and welfare of the recipient to avoid medical acuity or hospitalization. So some of the things that Garrett had been talking about, we dovetail together in serving people, trying to keep people out of hospital and in community. However, those increases were not allowed for increased administrative costs or changes in employment costs, including salary or benefits. The single state cost-based rate setting methodology for home and community-based services came into effect March 1st, 2011. And this methodology was based on recommendations from the Myers and Silver study in 2007 and 2008. Rates for home and community-based services, including personal care services, are governed by Regulation 7 AAC 145520, and all of this is in this report. Rates should have been reestablished every 4 years in 2014 and 2018, now in 2022, and so on, using provider cost data collected for rebasing purposes. Although providers have submitted cost surveys during this time, no rate rebasing has occurred. In 2014, 2018, we have not seen any rate rebasing. So providers are providing community-based supports without any rate adjustment. A fee-for-service system dependent on Medicaid reimbursement brought with it a litany of federal mandates, regulatory expectations, and changes at an unfunded administrative burden on providers. In addition, requirements under the Affordable Care Act, expectations to move to electronic health records, required under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, self audits required under Medicaid Reform, SB 74, Center for Medicare and Medicaid CMS study requirements, electronic visit verification, accreditation requirements, increased training requirements, requirements for new review, minimum wage increases, MMIS conversion in 2013, and required providers to allocate additional funds and human resources for compliance, again, without any rate adjustment. As we entered a worldwide pandemic in March of 2019, providers were already feeling the impact of statewide cost containment. The cost of providing support services continued to rise with no commensurate rate adjustment. I can validate that providers across the state are experiencing high levels of stress and fatigue, recognizing the path we are on is not sustainable. At that time that we closed our Harborview, we made a promise to people. Their parents were very reluctant to pull their kids out of Harborview, knowing that that institution would continue and be funded by the state. They were very afraid the community services would be in the state as they are today, crumbling, and that the kids would be at risk. And now those parents in their 70s and 80s are very afraid what is going to happen in the future. AADD has reached out across the state to try to analyze where are we today in terms of service delivery, because we've seen an erosion of the ability to provide services. The Great Resignation has impacted the basic level of adult support professional, as it has with service workers in restaurants, service workers in hotels, the lower level people, although we have been working actively to create a living wage for our DSPs because they are so important to providing our mission, it's been challenging. People have been walking away from those Costco offering far more than we can offer for a DSP, and that work is far more challenging. And they're working in COVID environments, and obviously, many things they already understand are well on their own. But just to give you some real-life examples, providers across the state are reporting that up to 50% of their shifts that they're trying to deliver are actually being provided by supervisors, managers, deputy directors, and CEOs. I can validate that since June of this year, I have worked direct service shifts every week. 33 to 66% of authorized services are not being offered due to lack of staffing. The result of the lack of community services is that a lot of staffing is being pulled into residential settings. We have to provide services for those who are we provide housing for, and many of those individuals have state appointed guardians, so they don't have a family as a backup plan, so that they can go home to. Just for example, in YPA, they have a staffing vacancy rate of 71% of providing services for the most vulnerable people in our state. We've seen across the state where crisis plans are inactive, staff out with COVID, and those replacements, guardians have been very distressed, yelling at providers, refusing to take their family members, and just saying, we just need to go get more staff. Turnover rates in our industry are high anyway. In Alaska, we've been very proud to have lower turnover rates in the nation, but now they've increased to nearly 65%. Some providers are actually paying staff to train to fit as they avoid background checks, because again, the malware attack in May was another variable that significantly impacted our ability to retain and hire and retain staff. But that has resulted a little bit, but in this dynamic of a work environment, people knocking on the door to work have a very, very short attention span, and they will wait a hot minute to get a job. But if Costco's going to hire on the spot, they will not wait for a background check in our industry. A lack of rate adjustment has demanded providers create their own cost containment measures, and I can assure you that we have. We've looked internally. We've reduced vacation and sick leave. We've reduced healthcare offerings. We've frozen and cut positions. Hope alone has cut 33 positions over the last year and a half. We've refinanced properties. We've sold properties. We've closed assisted living homes. We've had multiple-year operating losses. In 2018, we put into statute the DD Share Vision, which states that we share a vision of a flexible system in which each person directs their own supports based on their strengths and abilities toward a meaningful life in their home, their job, their community. Our vision includes supportive families, professional staff, and services available throughout the state now into the future. This is a vision that's in statute, a North Star that we're all trying to reach for. In this current dynamic, it's impossible to reach. And we have providers across the state wondering, what does the future provide for us in a system that does not allow for growth in the sense that we can't afford to stay in business with the current rates? I can validate what Drew has just spoken. We have been tasked with trying to help get people out of hospital, but we cannot do it without staff. And we cannot get staff without rates that we can pay them appropriately. So we ask this cycle of, I think another presenter said, we have a cycle of uncertainty. We just don't know how we can continue to support. And yet we made a promise to support the most vulnerable people. Tomorrow, the ending result is community providers collapse, an institution comes back to play, and the state is mandated to provide an institution. So the cost will continue to rise. And as Jerry said, if somebody's taken a hospital for 400 days, that cost will be good in a community. Can the community have the capacity? It just exacerbates the system. We're very concerned about access across the state. Providers have withdrawn services and access to services for people with disabilities is reducing. One of our board members at Hope is an assessor at Providence Behavioral Health. She works with families with kids with autism. And she has seen increasing stress with families because they know that they can't get services, that the average wait for somebody who's in a family setting that seems to be intact and healthy could be 8 to 20 years. There are still over 700 people waiting for services in the state of Alaska for the full Medicaid waiver. And families, there are many families that have been talked on that door about that service delivery system because it's so complicated for them. So we are a system in crisis. We are in a system that's crumbling, and yet it's so important for Alaskans to have access to community services just because they happen to have a disability, for somebody to be able to come out of the hospital and have access to a home service, for all of us that have loved ones that are aging to be able to go into long-term care and have staff available. I'm sure you've also read the article about how many staff are working away from long-term care services as well. So we are in a state of crisis, and I just wanted to validate that and add on to Jared's testimony that we need to fix it in order for Alaskans to be served. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. First, I'm going to go to Jennifer Parks.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Rowe. My question is about the rate adjustment number 7818 that you mentioned. You said that it should have been changed every 4 years, effective about 20 years ago, I guess. What do you mean by should have been? Was it an anticipation that would happen? Was it required by law? I don't know if you're interpreting what I'm saying. I'm very sympathetic, but it is sort of for me to make a case if I understand what you mean by should have been.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the document that I give you will outline very specifically the, you know, the path of how rates were adjusted and then the expectation for in that regulation. But there was an expectation that there would be rebasing based on that regulation every 4 years. And when we went into cost containment, it was put aside as a cost containment measure to not rebase those, not adjust those rates.
Is the key coalition sort of the central point of contact for the other organizations and other providers? I've just been here a couple of years and trying to figure out how all this works. And you gave a very good history. I recall the Harbor View Center in the 1980s, and that was a prominent central location in some respects, easier to keep track of. It seemed like it's a good idea to decentralize that, but now I agree with you, I'm seeing signs of collapse. If you will, on the street in the very commercial rural area. So I agree we have a huge problem to sort out, and it's becoming of the essence. I'm struggling to figure out the powers around looking for someone is sort of a central topic. Is that the key coalition?
Through the chair, yes, the key coalition was created actually, yes. Budget cuts, the Richard Fields administration in the 80s, and became an advocacy group of a coalition of providers and primary stakeholders and families. And we certainly have a wide range of partnership. The Association of Providers in the ADD is another partner within the coalition as well, but is also a coalition that has brought forth advocacy on these issues.
Okay. So remember the coalition.
You should remember the coalition, and you should remember that Ms. Harrell will be able to link you with other folks in your community.
All right, we'll go to other questions.
All right, Barbara, oh, sorry.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Randall. I'd like to go back to Joseph's question about the costs that were not rebased in several years. And do you have an idea if other states who are having a similar process about what those costs or the similar costs, the increments are what we're looking at now?
You know, I think that I'm not an expert in other states, but this report is in front of you, did an analysis of what other states are doing to help have you look at options that may help guide some opportunities to look at how we can match fiscal reality with what the need is to keep the community-based system intact.
I think you will definitely check that out. I guess, I wanted to comment that I think flexible. I think it's, we really need to think about how it affects family members. And oftentimes, family members may have to quit their job, but they would need to be careful for that because there are no places. We have a shortage of care places to fill, but most people go from one to another, adult child or whoever, to be having the most friendly environment possible. And I just think there are so many factors and how it influences family members. And our ability to make a living is important to consider. So thank you for this report. I'm lucky to hear that every family is able to do that. I also just want to mention from that Kimberly report that Ms. Taylor was referencing for the Alaska Association on the Mental Health Facilities. They identified during this 10-year time frame when rates haven't been rebased, there's been 15 additional sort of regulatory, legal changes that have been put on the industry. So compliance has steadily increased while rates haven't been rebased along the way. And, we know that that translates to an increased cost of doing business, and people who operate the business understand that increased regulation means increased billing. And we have a question during that time frame, but I will just note on the page that we are getting from some Dr. Sandra Heffron is convening an upcoming hearing to talk a little bit more about healthcare costs and whether we might be able to address healthcare costs in the state of Alaska. And with that, we want to make sure you get to all of our testifiers today. Thank you so much for your testimony and your story. We very much appreciate as well as your leadership of the team called Pushes in your journey to our community for help. Next up, we're going to go to Dr. Lisa Parody, the Alaska Council of School Administrators, who's joining us in the room. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to testify today. Good morning. My name is Dr. Lisa Sass-Parody, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Established almost 50 years ago in 1973, the Alaska Council of School Administrators is a very nonprofit organization that was created to serve as an umbrella organization for some of our future education associations in Alaska, including the Alaska Superintendents Association, Alaska Association of Secondary School Principals, the Alaska Association of Elementary School Principals, and our Alaska Association of School Business Officials, are also known as Alaska, and all school administrators in between that are serving our students every day. I want to thank Alaska for their work supporting some of the fiscal information in this presentation and for their finance expertise overall. They're a great resource for all of us. Thank you, Andrew. Let us note that ACSA, ACSA's primary purpose is to support educational leaders by providing a collective voice that champions possibilities for all students and purposeful advocacy for public education. ACR and members work together to develop our approach to position statements. We do each have a copy of these, and we're referring to them in the presentation. Joint position statements embed the highest priority for education policy positions, our student achievement units are number one priority, adequate funding remains our most critical need. And as I said, each of you do have a copy of this for reference. This graph adjusts the question to FY20. All data in this is in FY20 dollars for consistency. Here it does show the erosion of the BSA. In the earlier years of this chart, there were significant formula changes that were made by the Joint Legislative Education Funding Task Force. I believe some of those were incorporated in House Bill 273. This graph, there is no adjustment made in the last 3 years, so we're not done. But those primary changes were around inches of multipliers, new cost factors, adding funding for special education was the biggest factor driving that overall. But basically, this shows the downward trend of the BSA from roughly 6,400 in 2008 to roughly 2,900 again. So our demands of schools have increased, and so if they think about accountability, our social emotional needs of our students, state and national educator shortages at crisis levels, etc., not to mention fixed costs such as insurance, fuel, electricity, all trending up, the core funding is continually being squeezed. The chart shows the value of the BSA adjusted for inflation. Compare this to the nominal dollars. The next slide is going to show you how the value has actually decreased despite the amount not increasing. Is that clear that we expect more for schools while decreasing or we decrease most funding? This chart is the end of the grant position statements if you want to take a closer look at it. Flat funding for public education is a cut in the budgets of every public school in Alaska. It's just the facts. And it does not account for inflation. I always love this chart with the number two pencils. And I think somewhere in here is an apt metaphor for where we are in education stands compared to where we are for today's digital world. That's probably for a different time. When taking a look at the pencil chart, we get a better look at how education has been funded with adjustments for inflation. This chart goes back only to FY11, according to most of the Gender Centered Education Working Task Force changes. The inflation adjustment data set and methodology comes from the Legislative Finance Office. So I want to thank the Lexus Nature and Channel of Sullivan for the continued support in providing these numbers and their methodology. But I want to call your attention to, Chairman and members of the committee, is the blue line on the chart. It clearly shows the erosion of the inflation adjusting value of the base rate allocation, which is significant. The current BSA, 5,930, is worth only 4,525 in FY07 terms. Thus, the real value of the BSA has been cut by nearly 16% during this time span, FY07 to FY22. Districts have been asked to provide recent information to Representative Story's office about how the flat funded BSA and inflation have been impacting them in recent years. So that data gathering process is in progress and will be provided to you at a later point. The LSAT formula has been very helpful over the years, but weren't built into the BSA to secure the future. So when that funding is withdrawn and the cost of doing business does not go down, districts are trying to pay a funding. We'll see some of this happen from FY20 to FY21. These trends are clear and inexorably weakened public schools across Alaska, which is corroborated by what we all can see, the difficulties in recruiting and retaining our high-quality teachers and educators as our resources have diminished. And you'll hear more about that from the school district directly shortly. Nationally, inflation has increased 7% in the last year. In Alaska's all consumer price index increase of 7.2 last year. By flat funding education, teachers are left to fill the funding gaps. For the increasing cost of health care, utilities, student transportation, deferred maintenance, shipping costs, and supplies, money appropriated for public schools with flat funding will not stretch as far as it did in previous years. Right now, we are doing, we used to be doing more with less, and now we're doing less with less. The needs of schools across the state have also increased. There is a need for nurses, for substitute teachers, for counselors, and mental health specialists, for special education teachers, and this goes on. But schools can't budget for these needs without proper funding. The impact of flat education funding to school districts is so much more dangerous and urgent at this point in time due to the indirect impacts of the last 2 years. The pandemic has permeated every area of normal operations and heightened the issues that already existed to school district operating fund budgets. It is time to inflation-proof the BSA and to look at these very serious issues closely. Also noting that early notification of funding and stable funding is crucial to school districts' sound financial management as well as recruitment and retention of these quality educators. We really have been in a cycle of flexibility can ultimately impact construction negatively. Implementation of a long-term, multi-modern fiscal plan remains imperative to maximize the ability of districts to meet student needs. Diversified revenue streams are critical in the current fiscal climate to address any deficit and ensure the ability to enhance diverse increases associated with economic development, inflation, and deferred maintenance and capital construction requirements, while preserving the permanent funding for future generations. Reliable and predictable funding for schools will lead to district stability and increase student achievement. I thank you for the opportunity to testify and try to answer any questions. And I would like to also introduce Dr. Bridget Weiss, who is our current Alaska Superintendent of the Year. She's the Union School District Superintendent, and she is also the incoming president-elect of the Alaska Superintendent's Association and the Council of School Administrators. All right.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm excited to be speaking to this question. Thank you very much, Mitchell. And I found slide 5 absolutely fascinating, particularly the topic of expansion and actual value. I believe it's on the development of power each side here. But I'm wondering, can you give us a little bit of insight into how the inflation was calculated or adjusted for? Are you just using an actual figure or your feeling of what needs out there?
Thank you. Dr. Representative Eastman, the slide was prepared by the Legislative Finance Office, and so I would defer to Mr. Painter for the specific response, but I do believe it was against national rates of inflation, and I think we would need to clarify that if there's something new. I'm happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Dr. Murray?
Thank you. Here's my vote. A few years ago, I was working at a pump station, and a new manager came in, and he always paid us more to do every day, more to do, more to do, more to do. And he sort of picked up and asked the question, what do you want us to do first? And I think that applies to many of the services that are offered. We tend to think we can always put it on more. Does the Alaska Association School Board have some prioritization recommendations for focus on this, focus on it, rather than focus on everything?
Representative Fox, I am representing the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and you will be hearing from my colleague, Lamont Pearson, from the Alaska Students Association. I can say, I think it is for both associations who are very closely aligned, that our highest priorities are outlined at least in here in 2002. And I think that the ASB has a similar set of position statements, and again, they're very aligned. I think it's a reflection of our members who are in the field on the ground in your community serving our students. They bring these priorities forward. So I really encourage you to look at these, but it is a quick response. I think having timely, reliable, and predictable revenue for schools that is inflation proof is probably one of our most critical needs. And that kind of stability then allows for us to not focus on our outcomes for our students. That is probably one of our highest pieces. We're also very focused on the social and emotional needs of our students. I think that the last few years operating in a really challenging environment have highlighted areas of deficit in our state, and we have a shortage of nurses, social workers, mental health professionals, look at how do we ensure access to those professionals for every student, regardless of where they live. And I also think that another huge area for us is struggling with preparing a company and taking a qualified educator because in Alaska, we're still very heavily reliant on recruiting our educators from a year from today because the pools nationally have become much smaller. So a national education shortage is at a crisis level, and that makes our level of crisis even worse because we're still reliant on the lower 48 at this point. Our bachelor's and retirement and families have never been competitive, and when an educator can go to see someone next door, but our family is at this point going to choose that. So that's a very high priority for all of us. And I'm happy just because you're also learning about anything else.
I appreciate that. And this committee is really focusing on how to focus down on fiscal policy. We've talked about a bunch of more substantive educational policy related items. This jurisdiction is really focusing on fiscal policy, just a clarification for everybody.
ASA numbers in the budget that can one component of education funding. I hear from school districts that one of their problems is student contracts and about their pay raises in those contracts. Where does that fall in the funding portfolio? Is that a BSA issue? Because if that's for funding here, I don't see any contracts as listed. Not to say it isn't, it shouldn't be there, but. Would an increase in BSA help the teaching contractors at a certain
point? It is reflected in here, and our ability to attract quality educators is impacted by the erosion of the BSA dollars.
Thank you very much for your presentation today, Dr. Murray. We appreciate your time. You can come on up here to the press and introduce yourself and go over and see if you're guests tonight.
This mic. Sorry. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I will attempt to be fairly brief, and I just want to speak really to those fiscal impacts that we see as a result of not having our funding inflation proof. For the record, my name is Dr. Richard Weiss. I'm the superintendent in Juneau School District. I'm a product of the Juneau School District. I'm a third generation Juneauite, and I'm incredibly proud to be serving, completely exhausted, but proud to be serving the community of Juneau. Just a few thoughts. Most of my thoughts are probably going to be things that you're hearing a lot of around the impact, but they are real, and I'll try to give you a few specific details around some of fiscal impacts. So probably not hugely surprising to you given all of our personal and professional experiences around a lot of the increase in inflation. Our required expenses continue to increase over time. The obvious cause is inflation, but for education there are also compounding impacts that happen alongside of inflation. One you mentioned by shareholder or under a negotiated contract, and our expectations that our educators are paid for the hard work that they're doing and built in increases that we have in our negotiated agreements. A great example for Juneau in particular is our property liability auto and workers' comp insurance costs. Between last year and this year, our costs went from just our school district went from about $500,000 to about $1 million. So fixed costs became unfixed very quickly. We have to figure out how to absorb that within our required expenses of our budget. Next year, our property insurance alone will increase to another $452,000. That's like the other categories that may also go up. On top of that, our deductible for our property insurance has changed from $100,000 to $500,000 in the past 5 years. I think that's just directly right now because we're dealing with the flood incident at one of our elementary schools in our community. Our utilities, another example. We know that our utilities are increasing. Some of our rural district
actually have had their fuel flown in. Fuel gas, potentially fuel gas, and that pays in terms of invoices. Engineering versus technical about power system is SECCHAM. So SECCHAM went down early in the day, and we went to diesel power in general for a couple of hours. Thank you, AEMP, for giving us power back, but that's very expensive. A number of years ago, Gina had that experience, and that's been diesel for quite some time, and now you told me cost went up extraordinarily. So Gina, while not rural in those eyes, still faces susceptibility to increased expenses at the will of nature sometimes. Staffing at First Nations, I mentioned, we have got such important work to do with our children, and we can only get there with high quality educators, and we are competing for those. And we at the medical field have shortages in some of our highest paid positions. And so that just was a reality. It's an increasing cost in general, negotiating all three contracts this year, classified, certified, and our administrators. And we're doing that this spring. All three groups have worked extraordinarily harder and under different conditions in the past 2 years going on, so that will be an impact. Representative Story has served almost 2 decades on our school board, and in all this time is supporting our staff and students. During that time, we have continued to face this economic impact. Our middle schools, as an example, have one counselor for 500 students. One counselor for 500 students. I was at Thunder Mountain High School this morning, met with one of their counselors. We have a dual teen health center in our high schools. They don't know what to do. We have so many students coming each and every day looking for information, and we don't have enough clinician support. It is real. To meet that need is going to cost more, and we haven't been able to do that because of our funding situation. The substitute, again, huge issue in providing quality education. We're having to raise these wages in order to attract people to substitute in our schools. Our health team went from fully staffed nurses to have nurses have health assistants. We have a program we're using, and it's working, but it is a different resource for our students and our families than when we had our ability to pay for our full nursing staff. We lost instructional coaches. So we know we have achievement challenges. In June, we in particular have achievement challenges in three student groups. Our left native students, our students that are economically disadvantaged, and our English language learners. And our strategic plan is specifically written to increase the achievement levels in those three groups, and our hands are tied behind our backs because we cannot be innovative. We cannot have enough, we don't have enough human resource to get the outcomes we want for those particularly most vulnerable groups. In Southeast Alaska, our travel for activities has been hindered by lack of the travel of the ferry service to our Costco for operating and bringing these really important experiences for our students. We can't really advance and we do. We are super aggressive in finding grant services. These are limited in scope, limited in purpose, and they're not always sustainable because they do only, but they're not always renewable. So it isn't a strategic, wise way to build the foundation for one of the most important things we do, which is educate our kids. Facilities. So my last point is facilities. So with moratorium on our maintenance deferment, the deferment of our maintenance effort, our facilities, classic example. The roof is compounding the issues of the flood, state of the leaders, getting students back in that building. And facilities across our state are increasing the potential cost in repair and maintenance of those buildings because they have not been tended to. There is simply no money to do that, and it is creating an issue that is going to cost the state much, much more in the coming years. Closed is another one. We look at, yes, that was helpful, and it was money given to us through the federal government to respond to a pandemic, which we have now done going on the third school year. So those, I really sincerely do not know what we would have done. We would not have been able to operate schools without it, but it isn't the answer. It has been used for innovation, so that super parents from both schools and teachers don't have to ponder every year or feel like begging for whatever families that really just the meal that we should have to do for our parents. So I'm starting to open the question for you right now.
All right, thank you very much for that testimony.
You mentioned in your testimony that the issues that Riverbend related to this writing were made worse by your career situation. Can you talk about that? You sort of had a macro long session about the food being excused for us as a university. Did you get
that? So here's an example. The question says, food compounding issues at Riverbend, when is the flood? The other one is a water table issue that we need to repair, and we didn't have the money to repair, so we were delaying that. We were doing water table for bringing that through the cement flooring and impacting carpet and moisture levels in the building. We then have the flood issue, and on top of that, we have the flood issue. So delayed repair of the flood has created four different spots in the building. Where those bathrooms, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to re-populate, and that's going to hold up our return to that building with the most recent rain incident. We have freezing dams and such in the areas that are vulnerable on the roof, and so we've gotten more leaks than normal. We honestly have leaks recently, but it's more than normal in these couple of bathrooms where I won't be able to use them.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions about the roof?
The governor's budget for K-12 has been reduced. And they're saying that in part because of the migration of brick and mortar students to Vermont, and they're saying the reimbursement for the school district don't need as much money because they have those students actually in person at schools. You know that trend started during the pandemic, I think it's reversing. I don't know what the end result will be with the younger, whatever the population will be in October, and to be determined. If, let's say, that trend stays where it is, or doesn't reverse completely, and that number is the number that 4.5% people like, does the school district, if there are more students, remote learning and aren't in the brick and mortar, and therefore your funding decreases. You actually realize less expenses or you just didn't get the money as you did because you carried less money.
That's a great question for the chair, Vice Chair Hull. I would say, and perhaps Dr. Murray has something to add, but I would say we are making things in the classrooms that left to go to remote learning or what we would call private homeschool. Situations, and it is a bit of a wash, but because the formula recognizes and doesn't fund those students at 1.0, we get less funding, so we have less to serve them. We still have expenses related to that, we have staffing, and I'm afraid that in the climate sense of the pandemic hit, we as public educators are looking through the concept of choice schooling through a whole different lens because parents have choices and they're making those, and so we are examining all of our programming and how do we make this most effective and most lively where people will choose to stay with us and help us and have us educate them. So I think that there fiscally there is a bit of an adjustment. There's definitely lower costs associated, but as well, the revenue from those students is less. And so our students who are in the brick and mortar, and that's where we're still providing services to them, and the BSA attached to those kids is still relevant to that inflation line that you saw in the Instagram. By the way, I'll just add this. In 2017, you remember the RBC's recommendation was 2017, the 2400 grants cost 40 cents. Today, that same pack of credits cost $2.79. And green paper cost $2.97 in 2011. And today, it costs $13.69 for a green of paper. And of course, we are a paper printer. The pack of 12 pencils cost $0.47. Today, it's $4.19. So these are real costs that happen
so I'm not in box. I'm going to give you a $4,000.
Rising cost, rising fixed cost for us today. I really appreciate that. I would like to go to Ron Garrett, who is the executive director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, so I can go a little bit more about the impacts of their school districts. Mr. Garrison.
Yeah, good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lon Garrison. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. So today, I'm here to speak to you about the impacts of education funding, and in particular, the governor's proposal on educational funding for the next 10 years. Now, ASB has a number of resolutions that support what I'm going to tell you today. And those resolutions, in particular about long-term funding, revolve around our resolution that is entitled Sustained, Reliable, and Adequate State Fiscal Plan, the Education Funding for High School Students through a Non-Volatile Funding Source. And in addition, we also have a resolution stating urging early, adequate, and equitable and predictable funding for public education. So those two things I think are very pertinent to what I'm going to speak about. The governor's plan for education funding in the next 10 years maintains the K-12 funding after 2022 would be maintained at 1.25 billion through FY24. And then beyond that, there's a large 1.5% growth rate from FY25 and beyond. This would be beneficial if PSA would remain the same at the current level of $5,930 per student. And for the next fiscal year, very little will change after that point. Hopefully, I hope that school boards have been delegated the authority to implement a system of public education required by the Alaska Constitution, Article 7, Section 1. School board members are tasked with governing their districts and allocating those funds to execute an educational plan for all students attending public schools. It's a fairly complex task. The Alaska School Board had no taxing authority. They therefore must rely solely on the revenue from the state, the federal government, and in organized areas at least a minimum level contribution to fund education. Among the uncertain nature of annual appropriations for education funding as a part of the state's general fund budget, the potential executive vetoes continually creates uncertainty that makes it difficult to sustain the maintenance of effort in an effective and efficient manner. Time and again, boards and superintendents must make hard choices that may result in reduction of staff or the elimination of programs and services which can negatively impact student achievement. The recently presented 10-year plan for education funding put forward by the governor is a minimalist approach. It substantiated numerous of increased in tasks which were shown to you here just moments ago. And those tasks are really limited. While it appears stable and potentially sustainable, it continues the inadequacy that we face today and the needs of our public students. Let me highlight a few areas within the school district budget that are the biggest drivers. Salaries and benefits. Salaries and benefits make up an average of 80 to 85% of our district budgets. Most districts operate through collective bargaining agreements in terms of salaries and benefits. In most instances, those agreements include what we know as either a step and height increase or a full sort of wage schedule. Administrators for annual salaries see minimal growth that helps offset related inflation. In my experience, most of these schedules will work with about a 1 to 1.5% yearly increase. Using the governor's proposed funding plan, there would not be enough resources to exceed these current agreements without negatively impacting other elements of the budget. If we hope to improve teacher and administrator retention and recruitment, Alaska must become competitive with the nation's other salaries and benefits. Providing an adequate education for every student every day means we must keenly engaged in developing and retaining the best and the brightest, especially from the left itself. As a result of our inability to adequately find the education to put forward an example, one of the best services that NHB offers school districts is the facilitation of superintendent searches. Over the last 5 years, I've worked with school boards to find their next superintendent. I've seen the number of applicants diminish significantly. The experience and quality of those candidates applying has dramatically changed and are now dominated by applicants with no experience as a superintendent. More and more, we see candidates with minimal administrative expertise. Some of this is a result of the fact that the administrator and superintendent turnover is so high. There's very little time available for candidates to gain valuable experience as a building level administrator. Our ability to recruit and retain classroom teachers and ultimately become the principals and superintendents of the future is adversely impacted by public education funding that is unstable and inadequate. Maintenance and operations account for the next 10-15% of district budgets. This is an incredible challenge for school boards and the need for many changes, also to the infrastructure, as you just heard, Superintendent Weiss. For our education system to work, students and staff need structures to create conducive learning environments, whether they're physical or virtual. The human to human interactions between students and teachers and their fellow students cannot be understated. Maintenance is different to keep us practicing. Keep our schools useful. A good learning cannot be underscored enough. Most of the national schools think back to the 80s and 90s, meaning that most of them were nearing their useful design life, either their useful design life. School programs and administration of other expenses really make up the rest of the district's budget, at 5-10%. It's often within these school programs, such as extracurricular activities and educational programs and field trips and student family engagement, that we find those most intrinsic things that make students positively, that keep students involved in their schools. In closing, when I reviewed the proposed 10-year plan for education funding for the governor, the proposal is essentially flat funding. I don't see the opportunity and help to improve our system, to attract or train the best and the brightest to be in our classrooms, and to maintain our aging building systems. We see the continued struggle for school boards to meet only the minimum affordable effort with little room for a focus on innovation and systems to improve student outcomes. As I stated previously, locally elected school boards have been delegated the authority to implement a system of public education in the hands of the state of Alaska. In order to do that, they rely upon the state, local, and federal governments for that revenue. Local elected boards implement the local control model that has served the last school well and depend upon your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much,
Mr. Mayor.
I apologize for the
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gerson was very helpful. And I think that I'm certainly going to argue that we need to increase the budget markedly. Again, the good news is that there can't be a whole administration at once. We'll just have to pay those calendars. I do have a question for the chair. This document is for just our it's a 2007 report from the task force. Maybe this would cite something else.
I think we have to look a little bit during the time that there is
technology. You can't just be pulling money and something you've been working on that. It's not going to work for the U.S. Postal Service. It's not going to work for anything. You can just pour money in it without thinking about adjusting policy. And so then we've got to have to do again. We're not here just to maintain a school system as it exists. I think people, parents, it appears to me they're voting with their feet, even though they could get a free education in the public school library, an education that no parent wants for them. They're still choosing to forego that and take over responsibility for buying their own children's education. That may or may not be as good as public education, I don't know. But like the U.S. Postal Service, like ODAT, I think we got to look beyond just maintaining things as we're doing them and throwing them away at it. That's really what I'm doing.
Can I
make
a comment on that?
Yes, sorry to share. I couldn't agree more. I think that is the conversation that we need to continue to have. That we need to look for a new region where we can be as effective as we can possibly be. I think my concern, and those of school board members across the state, is like with new things, similar to what we heard with the long term care facilities and those kinds of things. But it's just a point where the amount of funding to be able to consider these broader possibilities is so greatly diminished, it's hard to even get there. It's because we're just in a crisis management mode. And I would love to have the day where we can actually talk about, okay, how are we going to be responsive to each and every parent in some way, shape, or form, so that public education serves all of the children in the
I don't think it is the teacher's fault or the administrator's fault. It's our fault as a society. We have to face those. We've waited too long, not in a crisis mode, but we're still in the dark.
Thank you very much for just joining me. Oh, we've got a question from our story.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for this past time. Thank you to all the school board members who are serving their communities as best as possible in this tough time that we've been in. So, thank you. Now, we didn't talk about people transportation at all, that wasn't mentioned today, and I'm wondering how we are doing keeping up with the cost of people transportation. And also, I should say, from Sarah Zinn, we did grants for food service and these other things, but if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, representing the story, I would say that what we see in general education funding, we are also seeing in terms of not meeting the needs of both transportation and food costs. For instance, food is one of the cost of food and the inflation that we've experienced over the last 2 years in regards to cost of food. I think it's something that has really been impacted school district budgets. And then along with transportation costs, and as Superintendent Weiss mentioned, the ability to insure districts and ensure those transportation costs have a huge impact on operating costs. So when you begin to add it all up, the ability to maintain adequate funding to do those is pretty significant. And some districts where transportation costs like Anchorage and Fairbanks, and even jail, those are phenomenal, and they have a huge part of their budget. So I would say we're challenged across the board.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your question. And thanks to all my guests as well, both to your members, the school board members. But if you look at the Constitution and the press, in Article 7, Section 1, does say regarding public education, that the legislature shall, by their own will, establish and maintain a school, a system of public schools for all children of the state, and may provide for other public educational institutions. So we have a minimum of an obligation to maintain public education. I think one of the things that is important
meeting, this is getting these hearings that we're starting to efficiencies and changes, and more concrete ways of seeing that the business is going to be